Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm on a conference. Am I supposed to identify myself?
I guess so. This is Mary from Cortland Hospice.
Yeah, hi. This I'm Susan from Metropolitan Jewish Hospice.
Oh, hello. I think we're the only two on right now, are we?
Oh, I guess so. It's a few minutes early. I guess other people will be coming on. That's funny.
I wasn't sure anybody was there. I just heard some clicking noises.
Yeah, same here. They said I'll connect you, but I didn't hear anything, and then I wasn't sure I was on at all or whatever. Where are you located?
I'm glad you spoke up. Cortland, we're just south of Syracuse, so we're upstate New York.
Okay, I'm in New York City, in the Bronx at the moment. So.
Wonderful. Is it warm there today?
Yeah, it's very beautiful. It's very windy, but it's lovely today. How about where you are?
It is actually lovely, as opposed to snowing 2 days ago.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, we had it so cold the last couple of days. Not snow, but a lot of rain and cold and just unpleasant. So.
That time of year, I keep wanting to put flowers out, you know, some annuals. I'm thinking, I don't know, they're still going to freeze at night.
Yeah, well, I don't know, but we've had, like, these tease times during April where we had 70 degrees and 80 degrees, and then we'd have 40-something degrees.
Yeah. Our heads, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely, but then it is only April, but, you know, it's it was kind of like, oh, are we going to skip spring this year and go to summer? But I guess not. but it's nice today, actually.
That's true. Hey, were you in the car yesterday?
No, I was not. No. I think Maya Jackson. Maya was. Yeah, so I work with her.
Is somebody else beeping in?
Yeah. Hi, this is Jason.
Jason?
Hi, Jason.
Hi, can you hear us okay?
Yep.
Hello, this is Carol.
Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Carol.
Who's on?
Well, I'm Susan from New York, from Metropolitan Jewish Hospice.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Mary from Cortland. Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Jason, you're there.
That's right.
Jason, okay. Who do you have with you, Jason?
I have Jamie Probst, the bereavement coordinator.
Okay.
At Point Shawna, we'll be in a bit.
Okay, great. Is there anybody else on?
Oh, yeah. It looks like our director of social work is here as well.
Good. And how's everybody doing today?
It's great. We were talking about here in the Bronx, the nice weather. I don't know about where everybody else is, but...
Yeah, actually, the sun is shining, but the wind is horrendous. It's
pretty. Yeah, here too, actually. So where are you all calling from?
This is Carolyn. I'm from Albany, and... Mary's from Cortland.
Right.
Jason's from Chautauqua County.
Okay. And I am in New York City, and right now in the Bronx.
Oh, so you're in the Bronx.
At the moment I am, yeah, because I'm fitting this in between my day. Usually we're based in Brooklyn. Our main office is in Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, yeah. At the moment I have a nice parking spot, so I'm good.
And those are the important things.
Absolutely, when you're out there, yeah, absolutely. In New York City, that is. I don't know if it's the same challenge as wherever, you know, other areas, but.
Susan, what is your role at Metro Jewish?
I'm the social work manager.
Okay. Who else has joined us?
It's Jan, Catskill Area Hospice.
Hi, Jan. Welcome.
Thank you.
Who else
is Carol, it's Ann Parada.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you. We missed you this morning.
Sorry. too many meetings all at the same time.
No, I hear you.
It's Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. We missed you, too, this morning.
For what?
We came over and met with Pat.
Oh,
remember? You set it up.
Oh, yeah, but I told you I couldn't be there. So.
No, I know.
I was with Ann.
We were together.
Mm-hmm. Good. We'll get started in a minute. Tim, are you on? I guess not. We're still waiting for a couple more sites that will be joining us, and we'll be all set to roll. I don't want to do my until everybody's here. Hi, who's here? Did someone join us? Hello, did someone join us?
Tim.
Hi, Tim.
Is that Carol?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Carol.
I'm sorry, yes. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
We're just waiting for a couple more people. We have Susan on from Metro, Mary from Cortland, Jason and his group from Chautauqua County, Lynn and Ann from Community Hospice, and Jan from Catskill.
Okay.
I was hoping Southern Tier would be here, but they should be here, I think, momentarily, and Buffalo. And so we'll just give everybody 1 second, and then I'll get started so we can go. Did people have any difficulty getting signed on today? Was it quick enough, or was it slow?
It was quicker.
It was quicker? Okay. Yeah, I noticed it was a little quicker also. All right. Well, we'll get started then. Good afternoon to everybody, and welcome to our second learning session with Dr. Tim Quill. And as you know, I'm Carol Sheenice, and I'll be the moderator for this session. And what we're going to talk about today is today's learning session is really going to talk about the two symptoms of anxiety and depression. And this is your opportunity. We would like you to share the interventions that you found successful for dealing with these two measures and any of the challenges you have. And Dr. Quill will expand upon your discussions and share his expertise and knowledge. And it's your opportunity as well to ask questions. So I just want to cover a couple of call etiquette details. Please, when you say anything, to use your first name before sharing and asking questions, and only one person speak at a time. And please do not put the phone on hold if you need to go away or something, to just either put it on your desk or something, but not put it on hold. Okay, so we can begin. And what we're going to start is asking you all to begin by discussing what successes you've had with the topic of anxiety and depression, and any questions that you've had, any challenges with both of those topics. So who would like to start? We're going to go around to each of the sites. So who would like to be first? If I don't have a volunteer, I'll call on somebody. Who's speaking?
Hi, this is Susan from Metropolitan Jewish. Obviously these are issues we deal with all the time. I'd have to say, it's so fresh in my mind, I just visited a patient today who was, you know, really exhibiting symptoms of depression the last few times I have seen him, and very tearful, very withdrawn, not sleeping, really, you know, very, I guess, typical symptoms. And he was given a medication by our medical director 10 days ago, which, of course, the common, you know, wisdom is it takes longer than that. But today, I told the nurse, he just looked so much better. But I don't think it was simply related to the medication. You know, he really was interested, looking, watching his TV shows, and you know, just a very, very different picture. But I think also because, you know, we had some discussion of their goals of care, allowed him to, you know, express some of what he was feeling. So that's just, you know, a very recent example. But I think those interventions, I think the support we all give, the being able to get a sense of what's underlying, what the worries are, you know, has been is often very helpful.
It is amazing how treatable and or helpable these domains are once you recognize that they're there. But I think the challenge is, one of the challenges is recognizing that it's there and not overly normalizing it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that's a challenge with the team. I'm a social worker, and I often have to be the one to say, but wait a minute, you know, what about this? Because there, you know, often different viewpoints, and it isn't always recognized.
Hello, I'm Leah Snyder, Director of Social Work at and I'd like to just share some of my input when we look at recognizing and treating anxiety. I think one of the greatest challenges is when looking at anxiety is trying to figure out where it's actually coming from, pinpointing that, looking at the history for the patients to see if there is a mental health history or already a generalized anxiety disorder that the patient has had throughout their lifetime and is just being exacerbated by new symptoms or diagnosis, or is it something that had just come up because they were recently diagnosed with possibly a terminal illness or a chronic illness. So I think trying to identify where the anxiety started for the patient as well as maybe a possible family member, and then moving forward to figure out how to treat it from there. So I think that's one of the challenges is getting that full assessment.
So there is this tension that we all feel and experience between how to screen for these things, which is often looking at the most surface level, and then kind of really understanding what's really there, and which really requires, I think, much more comprehensiveness and sophistication potentially. Does everybody screen everybody for anxiety and depression? They come in.
Always from Hospice Buffalo, and we do have that as part of our initial assessment screening, as well as the ongoing comprehensive that's done by the nurse, because the nurse is usually going out at least on a weekly basis, whereas the social worker may go out less frequently, unless it's obviously indicated. So in answer to your question, yes, we actually do screen all the patients for anxiety.
And in what way do you screen them? What's your strategy for doing that?
There's various ways. We obviously have our standard forms for Hospice Buffalo, and then each individual clinician might use a specific tool that they have, like a general anxiety disorder scale, again, collecting family history, seeing if there's anybody connected into a current outpatient setting, and collecting the community resources may not be involved with.
Mm-hmm. And for our nursing staff, we actually, well, and not only nursing, but also all disciplines, we do use the ESAS scale as, you know, again, as that screening tool. But as Leah said, I think what's critical is that, you know, at the time of an admission, you may very well have a person who is very anxious, and it may just be because of the, you know, the surrounding scenario, and it may not be a long-standing anxiety. So in all honesty, I don't know if we're actually capturing, again, whether it's just short-term or more of a long-term anxiety nature at the time of the screening, and that's, I think, something that we probably do need to look at in terms of, you know, knowing how to respond to that issue.
I think what's important, too, is assessing the environment as well as family members, primary caregivers, that's a real important piece as well. We don't typically, obviously, there's a question to be asked, are you feeling anxious or nervous? But then there's also questions that we ask around it that we aren't actually asking that direct question to be able to gain that information. And, you know, how are you sleeping? All of those other questions that come, a comprehensive assessment that maybe a patient isn't even identifying that they're anxious, but we might question them if they truly are or not, just based on other symptoms that they're having.
So how do you make a decision? Let's say you screen using ESAS and somebody scores in the medium or high zone. How does that automatically trigger certain things, or what happens with that?
What typically what happened was that, again, our social workers do go out either at the time of the first initial primary nurse visit, which is we have a separate access or admissions department, and that usually is done within a 24 to 48 hour time frame. But if there's obviously anxiety issues, the social worker would be alerted immediately through report to contact the patient and schedule a visit time so that those issues could be addressed.
Right. So then the social worker would obviously, you know, make sure that the patient is indeed feeling anxious before an intervention would be put in place. And some of those interventions may be a medicine intervention. It may be something as simple as a guided imagery or relaxation technique to teach a patient and family, a grounding technique, something physical if they're able to do that. So there's all different sorts of, you know, anti-anxiety interventions that we could put into place.
And also, I think along with that initial nurse assessment, what we would do is assess to see if the patient is on any anti-anxiety medications. Mm-hmm. And possibly at that point would contact the physician for further orders if the patient was agreeable to taking a medication.
And then we obviously have other therapies like massage therapy that could be useful, music therapy, those other support therapies around to assist if the patient is willing to use those services.
So these things get what are the, so all the wonderful services and options, what that doesn't get offered to everybody. It gets offered to people who are identified somehow as in need of those services, or how does that work?
You know, I guess it depends on, again, depending on the assessment of the social worker and the nurse, they would then determine what therapy might be most helpful to that patient and offer suggestions with regards to, you know, again, do you enjoy music? Do you find that, you know, helpful and to help you to relax? You know, they may introduce all those options and then give the patient a choice of choosing whichever one they feel would be most helpful to them.
So is everybody seen by a social worker, or just those who screen positive for anxiety and depression?
Our expectation is that everybody has a social work visit. We try to normalize that and explain to families that, you know, part of, again, hospice services is inclusive of a social worker for, you know, counseling and as well as a community resource person. And pastoral care is also available to them, and just essentially say that, you know, our social worker will be contacting you to schedule a visit. So everyone, the expectation is that everybody has a social work visit initially.
Yeah, this is Susan. Same for us and the social workers. In the vast majority of patients, you know, they do see them on a regular basis.
So is a social worker, let's say somebody scores an 8 out of 10 or something like that on anxiety or depression, is the social worker notified of that, or how are they made aware of that? Or do they do the same assessment on every patient?
Once the social worker goes out, they all do the same assessment. But if there was an identified need that anxiety was a major issue, we might even say that, you know, the social worker needs to contact the patient that day, or if it's at the end of the day, you know, the following morning. So the urgency of that social work contact, in essence, would be decided by the nurse that was assessing that patient initially. So if for example, we had someone that had an anxiety issue of 8 out of 10, when the nurse called report into the whole team, she would be clearly stating that social work needed to contact the patient today or tomorrow and articulate that clearly.
And is that referral driven by a given number or threshold, or how is that? Is that standardized in some way? Just trying to get a sense of what might be possible.
It can be derived from a given number. It could also be just based on observation and clinical expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Our overall policy with regard to our pain and overall symptom management is that any scores that are reported at a 5 or above need to have an intervention in place within 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So that's standard expectation.
Mm-hmm.
This is Millie from Southern Tier Hospice down in Corning, and I'd just like to give a little bit background about where I think our office comes from. And first of all, I think we've always treated our patients for anxiety, but it just is like in the last 5 years, and I've been doing this 19 years, the depression treatment seems to be more fashionable. And I think it's been report of observation by our staff. However, I had a doctor say to me this week, nurses, you should not be, or social workers, he didn't think, should be discussing and suggesting treatments for depression, particularly in these patients, that their doctor should be doing that. And I don't altogether disagree with him. To give people suggestions about SSRIs or even music therapy, whatever, that we really need to be involving the physician. So that kind of opened my eyes to, hospice over these 19 years has been like neighbor taking care of neighbor, but in a professional way. And we have been, I think, leaving medical out of this loop some. So I'd like to address that part of it as well.
So you'll be saying the question then would be, if you score over whatever your threshold is for doing on the screen, whatever your screen is, if it's greater than a 5, does the social worker go out and make recommendations? Or does the social worker talk to the physician, or how does that work? They might have a way to make that work in a way that seems inclusive or works well, or anybody gotten into trouble in that process?
I guess what I'm looking for is, this is Millie again, do we really have the expertise and the credentials to be, I mean, we can do a scale and give a number to the physician, but is it the physician who needs to be making decisions and suggestions about how to treat anxiety and depression? I will say probably 85% of our doctors, primary physicians, are going to say, well, you tell me, you're the hospice nurse. But then I have that other group that says, don't be suggesting these treatments to my patients without consulting me.
Yeah, this is Susan in New York. I mean, I would generally communicate with the nurse or bring these issues up at the interdisciplinary team and I would not be specifically discussing type medication or anything of that with patients. I might assess their openness to the idea of medication, and then the nurse and the physician, the nurse would follow up on that and or ask the physician about adult orders, and then be monitoring their reaction and the progress in that way. So I don't, as a social worker, I would not be, specifically talking about types of medication or anything like that. But I can, and I believe I can, assess and identify anxiety and, bring up those issues with the patient, the family.
And would you then collaborate with the physician, or would you have the nurse do that?
It's generally the nurse, you know. I mean, that's the way I would generally communicate it. The nurse is considered the nurse case manager. Not to say there couldn't be a situation I might directly call the doctor, you know, if the nurse wasn't available or whatever. But I would generally be the nurse that I would tell this to, or in the context of the interdisciplinary meeting with everybody there.
Mm-hmm.
And that it would be discussed by, you know, all the members in the team.
This is Millie again. Another question I want to find out if other people face this in their office. I have one side of the table that says, oh, those SSRIs, they should never have them on the market. I think this is situational anxiety and depression. You can't change the people's situation. I mean, they're like so negative towards them. Then I have another group who says, you know, situational or not, if it can be treated. I mean, can you treat situational depression? And this is something for Dr. Quill. I'm hoping to learn more about, I mean, I would think that you could. It doesn't matter if it's situational.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all probably going to give you a resounding yes to this. So the biggest mistake that's made in this domain is that, of course, they're depressed or anxious because they have whatever the disease is and they're dying. But in point of fact, medications and therapy still work, and a combination often works better than alone. So, and I think the data are extremely strong about this. So I do think talking to the physician, and sometimes if you are having trouble getting medications, going through your team so the hospice medical director can weigh in with ideas. I think your 85-15% is probably common these days, you know, where a lot of folks really just are of the treating physicians maybe wanting recommendations. And if your team can come up with recommendations, or the hospice medical director or somebody who's knowledgeable of medications can help in that process, that can really help things move along.
This is Lois from Buffalo, and just to interject, you know, the other intervention that we utilize at times also is having our team doctors, our hospice doctors, contact the community physicians and have a discussion with them, you know, when they, not only with, again, the anti-anxiety medications, but even with pain medications, to try to, again, have it a collaboration from physician to physician, and many times that's more well-received than the physician-to-nurse collaboration.
Yeah, this is Millie, and we certainly do that, too. I think that the biggest barrier to treating depression, and I'm going to say depression aside from anxiety because we seem to be all on board with anxiety, is I think I have some staff who block that. When people bring their personal bias to it, they're not going to see the symptom the way I am, and they're not going to bring it back to the team. So I'm like, you know, what do you do about that? Because I think there are people who have a bias. The people who work here, none of them have that bias against pain medicine anymore, because that's old school. But like I said, this treatment of depression is really just now fashionable. I mean, hospice, and maybe in the last 5 years we've been talking about this, and I can't say that everybody is on board with that.
So this would be an area where doing some kind of an in-service with your staff, getting somebody knowledgeable. There's also a very basic amount of information is in this palliative care primer that we do, and getting the chapters on anxiety and depression and circulating that to your staff, and then having a discussion about it. But that is something that getting an in-service going, because anxiety and depression are you know, and pain are probably the most treatable symptoms that seriously ill patients have. So our staff certainly ought to be very clear about the efficacy of both pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic treatment in this area. And there are actually some tricks too with regard to depression, including the use of Ritalin. When for low energy depression, when you don't have a month or 3 or 4 weeks to have an SSRI kick in. So again, Ritalin is a good adjuvant pain reliever, as well as a tremendously effective, rather quick treatment for low-energy depression. Certainly, my observation is that it's, in some instances, has saved prolonged lives in a significant way from people who were very withdrawn but not quite dying and a little bit of Ritalin, and they really have perked up for many months. So it's really something to know about, and if it's not part of your usual practice, and again, this would be something where your people may have to teach the general physician population as well.
Thank you. Great suggestion.
So do people use the two question screening tests for depression? Is that part of our second thing, the are you depressed and are you not experiencing joy? Are people using this screening practice?
No.
The first question, yes.
I think for a really totally basic screen, like what the nurse does on, you know, part of the Edmonton, the are you depressed and rated on a 10-point scale is sufficient. But for someone that you might suspect is depressed, there's the are you depressed, and the other is a screening for anhedonia. So there are people who will never in a million years say that they're depressed. You know, they would see it as a sign of weakness or whatever. They just don't see themselves that way psychologically. But then the second question is, are you able to enjoy things? And the sickest people who are sad, still, you know, when the grandkids come over, I still love it, you know, and, you know, they're still able to experience joy, whereas people who are depressed, you know, I don't care anymore, you know, I'd rather everybody left me alone, I don't enjoy the television anymore, or whatever it is that they used to enjoy. So anhedonia is the second question, and it really increases the sensitivity of the screen by a huge amount for depression. And there's some good research that it matches up well against like 20 question screening tests and all that.
What's that word you're using, anhedonia?
Anhedonia means the inability to experience pleasure. So it translated, are there any things that you enjoy? And again,
okay.
The saddest people, the people who are kind of going through tough times, they'll still often be able to enjoy little things in their life, whereas people who get really depressed don't. Everything's flat, joy disappears. So it's a really important another piece of depression that is really worth screening for.
I have a question. This is Susan. Would you recommend when you do get a positive score for depression, asking about thoughts of harming themselves, you know, suicidal ideation?
Very definitely. And
okay.
And actually, so I would definitely ask that. You'll often get conversation about that. So people are having thoughts about that. So, and having thoughts in my mind, it's somewhat normal. So it really, do they have any plans? Have they been depressed in a serious way in the past? Have they had prior suicide attempts? That starts to get into a completely more serious zone. But yes, I would definitely screen. And I would also do that with people who are really anxious.
Okay.
People have panic, you know, the whole data that people with panic attacks are more at risk for suicide than people with depression.
Oh, okay.
So people, panic attacks are very common, and if you have a propensity to panic attacks and you get a really serious illness, it often flares them.
Okay.
And those folks really, because they get so desperate and nervous, are probably at higher risk.
Okay.
Have you all had suicides on your programs, people who are suspected suicides?
Yeah.
Ones that you are aware were at risk?
The one case that I recall in particular, the patient had a long history and knew how to respond to the questions. Mm-hmm. This is Jan from Catskill.
Yeah.
And very well. And when they found him, he was very comfortable in bed with his hands across his, you know, chest, and that was it.
Yeah.
And he apparently had planned it all along, but any time the social workers went in there to talk with him, to evaluate him, to assess him, no, everything, you know, everything was fine. And
yeah, it certainly is it's a sobering event. I mean, particularly if you have a violent suicide or a, you know, one that's more of a desperate vision than that vision is, but if you do start to get those screen and teaching your staffs really to even probably the social workers, I would guess, are probably more attuned to doing that when they're going in for a more full assessment. Is that true?
Yes, we have provided a lot of education to our staff as part of the training that we do with our social workers. The director of social work does that on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, we have a policy where with any mention, the staff immediately notifies either myself and reaches out for a social worker to do the assessment. But at the same time, you know, everybody has to be somewhat knowledgeable about doing a suicidal assessment just to make sure there's no imminent risk.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's some interesting data from Oregon, you know, about the physician-assisted suicide thing, about what happens if we really create an environment where people can talk about this. In Oregon, one in 50 talk to their doctors about these issues, and one in 6 talk to their families about it. So, again, these ideas are very much on people's minds. So, but if people are scoring high in the depression or high in the anxiety area, that screening those folks and then doing some systematic, real, then thorough assessment as to whether they really are at risk is a really important thing.
I think the talking about it is so helpful, because I found very often if you ask about the underlying reasons for it, it's very often about fear of pain and suffering, and the whole idea that we're all in there is to relieve that, you know, and I find that very often really does alleviate those desperate feelings.
Yeah.
And we do a root cause analysis. This is Jan again from Catskill. Once we have an event like that where we, you know, we talk to the staff that were involved in the care of that patient, we talk to the attending physician, and, you know, were there any signs or symptoms that we missed that could have, you know, prevented this.
Yeah, that's really a useful thing. It's also useful for the well-being of your staffs to sort of help people make sense out of what happened and you know, how to understand whether it could or could not have been prevented, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So are any of the sites not screening routinely for anxiety or depression? Or does everybody have not using a quantitative measure to screen?
This is Southern Care, and we are not currently using a quantitative measure.
Okay. Do you have any measure, or how do you screen then?
Qualitative.
Okay. Qualitative on symptoms and history.
Mm-hmm. And so do you have a way of making sure everybody gets screened, or how does that work?
I think we're not adequately addressing that at this time.
Yeah. This is again where Edmonton, if you could begin to use just that one screening tool, it gets not only a pain, shortness of breath, but anxiety and depression, and would get be a huge step forward. Doing that, at least on admission, and then, of course, you have to figure out what you're going to do when people score high. And it is different. Go ahead.
She's writing down things. I was We have had a, this is Millie again. You're probably going to think, well, my staff's all on one side, we're the north and the south fighting each other here. But we, our social workers, using the Edmonton scale, has been a bit of a, you know, a bite in the jaw there, not wanting to feel that it's not extensive enough. But what I'm hearing here, that we don't expect anything from the Edmonton scale except to identify people who might need further screening. Is that correct?
That is correct. Edmonton scale is not, it's a screening scale. Now, you can follow the score, you can follow that score to show that you're making success, and that is actually if you're looking to demonstrate quality in your program, and you take the people who have high scores on day one and you measure them again on day seven, and most of those scores have gone down, and this is what virtually every palliative care program and many hospice programs who have quality management, this is all they do. They take one of these 10-point scales, they measure day one, and they measure some point in the future, and they show, boy, moderate to severe symptoms, we can take those sons of guns down, and it looks great, and it is great, because it really lets you know whether you're having success. But it is not the same. It's not a thorough assessment once you screen somebody positive. So it's just like if somebody scores a 10 on a nausea scale, well, it doesn't really tell you what to do or what's the causes of the nausea. You have to then kind of do an assessment that's more thorough, and I think that would be the same for anxiety and depression.
Okay, I have a social worker here in the room with me, and believe it or not, she didn't slap me when she just, that last thing I just said, but I would like, Robin, would you weigh in on any concerns you have about this initial assessment?
I think one of the concerns that social workers have had is that we felt that the Edmonton scale was not normalized for a terminally ill population, that it perhaps not allowing for the normal response of anxiety to the situation that they're in, and basing it off a baseline normal of the population in general.
Yeah, Edmonton, again, I'm quite sure that Edmonton was developed for the use with seriously ill populations. Again, so, but you will find many people when they're first going on to hospice, as an example, will score high on anxiety scores. I think if I were first going on to hospice, unless I was a lot more evolved than I seem to be right now, would probably score very high on an anxiety score. But it doesn't mean there's anything wrong necessarily, but it would, if I was scoring at a 10 and it was just my normal anxiety around getting into something like that, it ought to be down in a week. And you can make the argument that you ought to know that my normal anxiety is pretty intense at that point. So I do think it doesn't preclude you from using more sophisticated scales that have been developed for these populations, but it really is, it's a huge step forward from not doing anything, because it lets you know people who are self-rating in a very high zone. Now, again, my 8 may not be the same as yours, but you can certainly follow my 8 over time for me, and if it's getting better, you'll be able to demonstrate that quantitatively.
So what an appropriate, sometime an appropriate intervention would be to just monitor for another week or so? Or
yeah, I think if somebody scored in the very high zone in anxiety or depression, I think it doesn't mean you're going to give them medicine or anything, but you probably would want to, again, the way it sounds like most organizations then would have social work go out and talk to them and do a thorough assessment, and they might decide, you know, this is pretty normal, just let's watch them get settled in and recheck it again in a week.
Right.
And I think that would be a perfectly appropriate intervention. Mm-hmm. But it is different than not doing anything. And the other thing that's so that without collecting some kind of a quantitative measure, it seems to me it's so easy for people to fly under the radar screen, or for the, because we all have huge variation in the intuitive skills of the folks who are doing the assessment. We all think they're great, but they may be great but have certain blind spots. And a quantitative measure really helps compensate for those things.
Dr. Quillen, what kind of score would you use if the patient was cognitively impaired? Can you still use the Edmonton?
It's much harder. So again, if they're cognitively impaired, you can't use self-report, and it's a self-reported scale. Now, again, a lot of the folks that we see have either normal capacity or pretty good capacity. You can have the family help you fill out this form, and it's not as good, but it at least gives you something. I think it's much harder for cognitively impaired patients. So there isn't a simple substitute for the cognitively impaired. There are substitutes for many of the key elements.
This is Jason from Hospice Chautauqua County. Just so everyone knows, we've been dropping the call about 7 times or so we haven't been participating. We'd like to squeeze in a question before we get dropped again. Would that be okay?
Sure. Let's just finish off this one. So anybody have any good measures for the incapacitated patient, for screening the incapacitated patient for anxiety or depression?
Pain ad works.
Yeah, for pain, there's good measures for pain, and there's fair measures for shortness of breath. When you get beyond that, I think it's tough. I think it's then talking to the family and making your best guess, and it's imperfect, but it's what we have to do. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is a bereavement counselor, Jamie.
I'm just curious, how do you differentiate between a situational anxiety and depression and anticipatory grief?
How do you do that in general or conceptually?
How are other hospices doing that?
Okay, let's throw it out open to the group, and then I'll give my thoughts about it.
I think we would like to hear your thoughts.
You're talking to me?
I think the question you know to ask people about enjoying things is a really good indicator, because I think it would be more likely if it's anticipatory grief there would still be some of that, even though there will be sadness and expression of the anticipatory grief.
Yeah. I think there are different ways of diagnosing each of these things. I do think, and there might be anticipatory grief may be contributing to depression, maybe contributing to anxiety. So to some degree, this is something that's going to in conversation with the patient. I feel like I'm losing the beeps going in and out, or did I lose whoever was asking this question? You still there?
I think that was Chautauqua. Jason, are you still there?
Okay. I'm Jason Stone.
Wonders of modern technology, huh? So I think the way I think about these things, and I suppose I'd say this, I think anticipatory grief can contribute both to depression and anxiety, and then you have assessing depression and anxiety as to their severity, whether they need biological treatment, whether they need conversational treatment or other kinds of non-pharmacologic treatments. Those are very individual decisions, although I will say as depression and anxiety get on the severe end of the spectrum, I'd be inclined to offer pharmacologic therapy as a piece of the puzzle, just because I do think if your anxiety level is extremely high, it's very hard to concentrate enough to do anything. And similarly with depression, if it's more on the more severe end of the spectrum, it just has so many cognitive effects that it's hard to just work cognitively unless people really don't want to use medicines. Is that other people's take as well?
Yes.
The Ritalin thing is something if you all are not using it, you ought to learn about it. In our primer, there are some primary references around that, but it's really, really helpful in low energy depression in people who are really seriously ill. And my observation is, it is many times life prolonging and really quality of life enhancing for low energy depression. And it works quick for the folks who don't have a lot of time.
We have had success with that. Some of our doctors at Hospice Buffalo have used that in patients with depression and have had a quick turnaround, not waiting the weeks that sometimes you don't have with patients to see a difference within a day, a 24-hour period.
Yeah.
This is Jason from Chautauqua County again. We just got back on the call. Is there a way that we could hear some of the comments summarized very quickly based around our question?
I'm so sorry you're having this difficulty. I think what I had said was that anticipatory grief is often a real factor that feeds into depression or anxiety, and sometimes there's depression and anxiety together. So I do think that is a place almost always to look for some of the psychological underpinnings for what's going on. Having said that, the more severe end of the spectrum, depression and anxiety, I do think often needs pharmacological therapy, even if whether or not it's related to grief, or a combination of pharmacological therapy and conversation and support and other kinds of non-pharmacological treatments. And then we talked a little bit again about Ritalin for depression being a particularly useful thing in this population because it acts so quickly and it moves energy up. Now, for the people with mixed anxiety and depression, Ritalin is not very great because it can turn up the volume on anxiety as well, and a lot of folks do have a combination. But low energy depression, Ritalin works so fast that it's really useful in this population.
Thank you for that. Can we get one more question in before we lose you again?
Sure.
All right. Are there any specific assessment tools designed to assess depression or anxiety in the terminally ill?
Well, again, you're talking about there's screening tools, and the screening tools, I think, are variations of Edmonton. You know, they're 10-point scale, one question. And I think those are good starting places. And then assessment scales, there's a whole range of assessment scales, and some of which are better than others in the terminally ill, you know. So the challenge of the assessment tool, you know, the longer depression inventories and that kind of thing, they have questions on them that have to do with, you know, preoccupation with death, you know, not eating very well as symptoms of depression, and you know, they're just not great. They're not great parts of the tool in this population. On the other hand, they do have a lot of good questions in them. So I think from a screening point of view, the only besides just asking, are you depressed, and if so, rated on a 10-point scale, which is basically Edmonton, and same thing for anxiety. The other part of the screening for depression is the screen for anhedonia, because you will miss a lot of depressed people who don't want to psychologically admit that they're depressed or whatever. They may not experience it as depression. But when you ask them, are you enjoying yourself, they say, no, everything is flat. You know, even things I've loved forever, I can't stand anymore. I don't have any juice for it. And that's a really good question. That will pick up another big group of people who are depressed. The other piece that to fight, and this is something with our own education, with our staffs, and working with the doctors we work with, is that the sort of normalization of depression, anxiety, and the terminally ill, which, you know, sadness is normal. Depression, it may be common, but it's very treatable. And so even if you have damn good reason to be depressed or a damn good reason to be anxious, it's still responsive to the same treatment, both pharmacologic and talk.
So what if they're not enjoying things that they used to enjoy in college? They just feel sick. Would you still want to treat that?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would, you know, it would, if they weren't enjoying, you know, you'd have to kind of figure out what that means. So if they were throwing up all the time, you know, and they weren't enjoying it, you know, then the challenge is to try to treat the throwing up.
Right.
But the not enjoying, you know, the little things that they've always loved, and if there's not a palpable explanation for that, I think that's depression until proven otherwise. And again, if it's not too severe, it may just be talk therapy. But if it's in the more severe end, you know, it may be anticipatory grief. There's a lot of things it could be. Saying that it's and we can say it's normal, but it still warrants exploration. And because most people, even the really sick people who aren't depressed, will still enjoy some of the little things.
Right.
Hi, this is Tim from Albany, New York, and Community Hospice. I have a question that maybe could be addressed by both the doctor and or the hospices around. We're having difficulty working with the Edmonton scales as well, along the lines of anxiety, and we're trying to figure out what will work best for us and our patients for outcomes. If the patient cannot give a number for that anxiety along the lines of Edmonton scaling, can you help us out with that?
Yeah, so we actually have changed. There's two ways of doing the Edmonton scale, and both have been validated. The 0 to 10 scale and the mild, medium, and severe scale. If I wasn't going to use the 0 to 10 scale, my second try in that would be, is it mild, moderate, or severe? And to try to see if they can make a choice between those adjectives. And again, there is a whole Edmonton scale that has been validated that just uses those adjectives. And if you can move somebody down a notch in that, that's the same as moving them down a couple of numbers on the Edmonton scale. So it is significant in terms of its clinical effect. So again, that would be my second try. And you know, if they really don't want to do any number or assessment or anything, just try to get them to describe it, and then you're sort of out of the quantitative realm. But then it'd be presence or absence, I suppose. Others have techniques for doing that with folks who don't want to put a number on it or don't want to.
Well, I think that when we're talking about depression, one of the things that we haven't mentioned, again, this is Leah from Hospice Buffalo, social worker, is that if we look at the diagnostic criteria for, say, let's use, for example, major depression, because there's so many subtypes of depression, that typically people just need to experience those symptoms for 2 weeks to really be calling that a depression. So I think that sometimes we're asking, do you have feelings of sadness or anxiety, or, you know, are you not feeling joyful? Are there things that you used to enjoy doing that you no longer do? I think that when we're trying to figure out, do we have somebody who is depressed, there are many other things other than their self-report that we can get from family members or even their environment if we see, you know, and we can distinguish it as well from their sickness. If they were just diagnosed in the last week, but they report that their house and their bills and things like that, they haven't been doing that very much for the last 2 years. You know, there's other indications just by, I think, looking around in their environment and other tools that we have, like that diagnostic manual that isn't specifically written for somebody who has a chronic or terminal illness, but we can still use it as good clinicians for diagnostic reasons.
Yeah. So again, I think that's an important point, and that is that these screening tests they're not an assessment. You know, they're not a thorough assessment tool. So somebody scores high, then the idea is to go into some more, either another tool or some other sophisticated kind of assessment process so you can decide whether and what kind of intervention is needed. But I do think that people in the moderate to severe zone, that's a good way to decide who needs to have that more severe, that more serious evaluation.
This is Jason with Chautauqua County. We're back again. Could you finish up? When you mentioned that there are some depression and anxiety assessment tools that are better than others. What direction can you point us to start looking for the more appropriate ones?
Well, there's the Zung and there's the Beck. There's a probably three or four standardized tools. Did we lose you again, Jason? Did we lose you? There are two or three or four standardized tools that can be used. They all have to be a little bit adapted to this population, again, because some of the markers that they have are just are very common in terminal illness. Again, losing weight, not sleeping, thinking about death. These are things that are going to be scored on there. So, what actual numbers on these more sophisticated tools you're going to use, I think, there's a lot of debate about that. They do touch areas, you know, the common areas of depression, though, so they do give you valuable information.
Sam, thank you. I think our time is up if there's no other pressing question right now. Okay. Well, thank you all very much. Thank you, Dr. Quill.
Thank you all.
And all the rest of you have a good day. And if you have additional questions, please email them to me, and we'll be able to continue to circulate this discussion.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now.